This is Philosophy 202. It's Monday, January 10th, 2011. So we just watched this clip from The Matrix. And so the question I have for you is, what does this have to do with Descartes' meditations, particularly meditation 1 and 2? Again, if you want to participate in our conversation here, please speak loudly, particularly if you're in the back of the room. So make sure the people listening to the podcast can hear you clearly. Any thoughts? Yes, sir.
Is it just questioning everything you think you know to ensure it's real?
Yeah, that's what Descartes does at the beginning, right? He says, what if it's all a dream? What if I'm the victim of some arch deceiver who is feeding me false sensations, false information, false beliefs at every turn? How would I ever know?
So we're not even physical? We don't even have a physical body, that we might just be a spirit?
Yeah, he asks, how do I know I even have a physical body? I have sensations, but what are sensations? Sensations are just states of consciousness. What if I don't really have a body? What if I'm having sensations fed to me, fed to my soul by this omnipotent and not benevolent, but in this case, an evil being? And so he assumes, basically, what if God was the devil? And there wasn't a God, there was only a devil. And his plan for humanity is to feed them false beliefs. And that comes in more in meditation 2. Meditation 1, he's not assuming there's kind of a puppet master, but he's assuming that the life is a dream and that it's illusory by its very nature. There's no omnipotent evil genius trying to deceive you in meditation 1. It's just the idea that perhaps it's like a dream. And so he gives the example of sitting by the fire, right? He says, well, I'm sitting by the fire, and I've got some paper in my hands, and I'm dressed in my smoking jacket, and I can feel the heat from the flames. And all of a sudden, I wake up. And it turns out that all those things which I previously thought were true were actually false. I'm not sitting in my chair. I'm lying in my bed. I'm not dressed. I'm in my night clothes. I'm not warmed. It's stone cold in my bedroom. And so all these sensory beliefs, which we take as being as a sort of paradigm of something you can really put your faith in, turns out that they were all false. So then the question is, when I'm in the dream and I'm feeling the heat and the fire, it seems like it's real at the time. So how do I know I'm not dreaming now when I'm looking at my hand in front of my face? Yes, sir.
Well, he came up with the idea of like a priori.
A priori.
Well, basically, he was talking about saying, like, even if he represented like a dream as like a painting,
mm-hmm.
and he said that even if the things in the painting are fantasy, you're still using colors that have to exist in order to paint the illustration. So he's saying even if this isn't exactly what reality aligns to, all the components of it are a part of reality in order to exist.
Right, so he's kind of, and you might notice that in the meditation he kind of jumps back and forth. It's a kind of a stream of consciousness. So one of the things he considers is even in a dream, dreams are made up of, as we think, components from waking life. So I remember one time I was watching, I watched a war movie, and I ate spaghetti for dinner. And then I had a dream where I was in a Sunday school room, and someone threw a grenade through the window, and it exploded, and it blew off my friend's arm, and there was spaghetti coming out of the wound, right? So you can see how these different components of waking life can manifest in dreams. Sometimes they bubble up from the subconscious. Sometimes you can't really figure out where the bits and pieces are coming from. Or sometimes it's, you know, people have dreams of falling or being chased by bad guys, and it's a manifestation of anxiety. But you never experience anything in a dream that you haven't also experienced in waking life. And so So May, is that an answer? What do you think? Descartes actually goes back and forth with this and says some things which seem to go against that. Well, what do you think? Is that a proof that you're not dreaming now? Well, what if you've been dreaming your whole life? Right?
You wouldn't know.
Have you ever woken up in a dream within a dream? You're being chased with a scary monster, and then you wake up and you're like, oh, phew, it was all a dream. And then you sit up in your bed and there's a monster like laying next to you, right? Or what have you. You know, you get these people do experience these. They're not as common as normal dreams, but you can have this sort of layered dreams. So how do you know you haven't gotten to the top layer yet?
Well, there are, if it's, reasonable, like, everything has to be within reason. 2 + 2 has to equal 4. Squares have to be 4-sided. Triangles 3-sided.
Yeah, that comes back to these a priori beliefs. So he says, okay, well, maybe sensory beliefs, maybe those can't be believed because they don't seem to have to be true.
Well, we all agree, too, to say that we're not dreaming right now.
Is agreement, even if it's universal, is that good proof for something? Has there ever been any beliefs that have been held by almost all of humanity that turned out to be false?
Sure, yeah.
Well, who's to say that, there's not another layer after right now? Like, you sleep and then you wake and maybe there's, another layer past that. Maybe in death or something,
Yeah, a lot of the Eastern religions say that being enlightened is a matter of waking up. The Buddha, the word Buddha means awakened one. He's the man who woke up. He woke up to the reality or truth of the world, much like in the Matrix. He became enlightened.
Well, even Western religions, Christianity talks about a rebirth.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, that's more of a metaphysical transformation. It includes knowing certain truths. But I think the Eastern concept, it really holds that the world is kind of an illusion. If you look at classical Buddhism and Hinduism, it sees the world as being less real than consciousness. Whereas in Judaism and Christianity, the physical world was created by God, and it literally exists, and it exists in a robust sense, not as some sort of manifestation of consciousness. It's a separate existing thing from God. But this idea of waking up to the truth is certainly pretty universal in religions, I think. But what about this idea of a priori beliefs? So Descartes says, okay, well, maybe I can't know I have a hand in front of my face, but can I know that 2 + 2 = 4? Or that a triangle has 3 sides? In geometry. He goes back to geometry and mathematics, which seem more certain, because you can probably think of times where you've made a mistake in perception, right? And you can think about, there's optical illusions, right? You take a stick and you put it into some water and it looks like it's bent. And you take it out and you see it's not bent. Or you see these waves in the distance on a hot day, and it looks like there's water up there. And you get there, and there's no water, and the waves are up ahead more, right? You get these optical illusions. Or sometimes you think you see your friend, and you tap them on the shoulder, and they turn around, it's not your friend, and you're embarrassed, right? So, or it's like a doppelganger, someone that looks almost exactly like your friend, but there's something a little off in the eyes, and you realize it's not. Or it turns out to be his twin brother, right? So you do get these mistakes in perception, but have you ever been mistaken about a basic truth of math and geometry? Not like the complicated stuff, but like 2 + 2 = 4, a triangle has 3 sides. Descartes says, can you really be mistaken about those? And that at that point, he launches into the evil genius thing and wonders, well, okay, maybe I'm not ordinarily mistaken about those, but if you had an omnipotent being who dedicated all of his resources to fooling me, maybe he could fool me into thinking that 2 + 2 = 5. There's that scene in George Orwell's 1984, at the very end of the book, hope I'm not spoiling it for anyone, when you have Winston in room 101, he's being tortured, and as he's tortured in this extreme way with his worst fear, he finally believes that just for a moment that the number of fingers held up by the torturer is different than the number he actually sees. So, like, I can't remember, 3 or 4. Anybody remember the scene? the very end, he says, how many fingers are I holding up? And he says, four. And it's like, wrong answer, there's three. You know, give him some more torture. Mm-hmm. And he's like, four. And finally, he just for a moment, he sees, I can't remember what the number is, but the three fingers. He sees three fingers, even though there's four there. His perceptions deceive him because he's been tortured. And I think that's the moment they finally decide, okay, now we've proved our point, now we're going to kill him. And that's just like a government, right? So imagine like this sort of metaphysical being who's devoted all of his energies to fooling you. How could you ever know that you're not being fooled by that sort of a being? And if you don't, how do you know there isn't such a being who's fooling you? Thoughts? Or come back to the Matrix if you like. How do you know you're not in the Matrix? Or something like it. Aside from the idea that using human beings as living lemons to generate electricity is the most ridiculous thing you ever heard of. I hope I'm not having spoiled the Matrix for you. 1999, I figure it's been 11 years. It's a cool movie. If you haven't seen it yet, it's a cool, awesome movie. And with a lot of heavy-duty philosophy in it, you know, and inspired largely by people like Descartes.
Isn't it a culmination of, like, more than one thing? It's hard to put one finger on it, you know? In order to even perceive that 2 + 2 = 2, I have to be able to hear you say it or see it with my eyes or something like that. So I know that my perception can be off, you know, you can be deceived in that way, but you still need your senses.
You might need this like a sensory like representation of it, but doesn't it seem like 2 + 2 would be 4, even if nobody knew it? In other words, the way you learn 2 + 2 = 4 is maybe by hearing sounds or learning to count and then seeing objects. But I mean, once you understand that 2 + 2 = 4, could any new perception ever change your mind about it?
What about hypnosis? You know, there's people that have been told that the number 7 doesn't exist in hypnosis, and they count to 10 and they skip the number 7.
Okay, well, they're counting, but wouldn't they figure out something's wrong after a while, though? Like they're doing trying to do some math. They get some math problem and they don't get 7. They're going to keep up ending up with like the wrong answers, right?
Yeah.
Or what are they going to do when they see the number 7? And if you give them like an accounting, like a ledger, and they have to reconcile the ledger and add the columns down and across, they're going to keep on getting the wrong number.
Wouldn't it be foreign to them, though? That number 7 just wouldn't exist in their memory bank for that. So when they saw it, it would be like looking at another language.
Yeah, I'm not sure what they would see. I think that the probably hypnosis caused them to just pass over it. See a couple of hands up. I'll get you first and then you. What's your name? I'm trying to learn some
names. My name's Matt.
Matt.
Yeah. So to me, I mean, if you're calling life a dream, that's just pretty much putting a label on what we're living in every day. And that's not necessarily meaning anything significant. Like, you can call a dream is when you're asleep or when you're awake, but it seems to me like the way that we dream, there's a lot of odd things that go on in dreams, like things that don't make sense. Like, you'll look at your friend, and your friend will be there, and then you look at him again, and it's, you know, a girl or something. Like, just something crazy, but you can still recognize them. So I feel, if anything, that if there's any, like, power that might be manipulating our thoughts, I feel like it might be in our unconscious mind when we're sleeping instead of when we're awake, realizing things that we know are true because we use our own mind to think about them more than we do in dreams. We don't really think for ourselves. It seems like almost our minds think for itself instead of our consciousness or something else is thinking for us, you know?
Right, so I mean, you mentioned a couple of things there. I mean, one is that the phenomena of the dream seems to be different than the phenomena of waking life. And you mentioned things happen in dreams which don't ordinarily happen in waking life. The dream world is less stable, right? You turn your gaze back and forth and you'll see something different than you just saw a moment ago. And scenes and locations and people seem to morph into one another. It's more fluid. And also, things happen in dreams that don't happen in waking life, like, you know, you're able to fly, or, you know, there's monsters, or what have you, that you don't see in waking life. But it seems that you're assuming that the dream world, that's the fake world created by your brain, and waking life, that's the real world.
Well, he's assuming the other way around, but... I mean, he's assuming that bad things are being manipulated in our minds when we're awake, but how do we know they're not the good things and the bad things are in our dreams? Because aren't the good things usually when, like, you realize something for yourself and you're not, like, a lot of times you have moments where nobody tells you anything, you just kind of realize things for yourself, or you kind of realize something without anyone having to explain something to you, but you're using your conscious mind to think about it. In dreams, you don't even know how you dream of certain things. So, I mean, how do you know how you thought of things?
Yeah, dreams are also more passive. And so, typically, and there's other aspects of dreaming, like you have this kind of tunnel vision that you typically experience things happening to you. But then, and one of the things you said was interesting is, how do we know there's this arch deceiver? And Descartes says, well, you know, there's not an arch deceiver. How do I know I'm not dreaming? Well, how do you know you are dreaming? So there might be some question about, you know, where does the burden of proof lie? Does it lie in me to prove that there is an arch deceiver, or is the burden of proof on Descartes to prove that there is one? And I'll get to you and then Isaac. See, your name is, you just told it to me. Tell it to me again.
Wyatt.
Never mind.
He's going to be saying kind of what I was going to say.
Okay. Okay, Isaac.
So, I don't know, what I get basically from it is it seems like most of the dreams are almost entirely based on perception. All your senses are incorporated in, and we already know that perception can be false. So, if we subtract perception from the equation, then what we're left with is logic and reason. And since logic and reason don't change, then when we're in our waking state, if logic and reason align with perception, then we know we're awake. If logic and reason disagree with perception, then we know either we have a false belief or we're sleeping.
Okay. Break some stuff in here. And then this idea. So if here's a suggestion. If reason and perception agree, is that what you said?
If logic, reason, and perception agree.
No. And just mention a couple of things that we were talking about. Dreaming tends to be more passive, where you're active in waking life. Dreams, you get they're more fluid. Waking life is more stable. And what else? Monsters, lying, etc. All the crazy stuff that happens in dreams. You know, the teams of women fawning over you when that doesn't happen in real life. You know, all kinds of stuff, both good and bad, can happen in dreams that would never happen in ordinary life. Whereas waking life, you get sort of I'll put this in realistic
clarity.
Things happen, maybe more predictable, and also there's dreams tend to be more hazy.
What about, I don't know, this is kind of stealing from Inception, but what about memory? I mean, in waking life we can remember where we were and what we are now. In dreaming we don't really recall where. It's all in the now and present.
Yeah. Dreaming, you get, there tends not to be a context in dreams, and this has to do with, I think, your access of memory, where you do get context in memory, It's interesting about what this might have to do with what dreams are. You know, some of the theories about dreaming is that your mind sort of going through various scenarios and kind of storing information in your subconscious mind to try to prepare you for permutations of situations you run into in during the day. So the idea is you know, you're living in a cave and you run into like a snake and you're not sure what to do, and what you do, you have like a stick, and so you stick the stick out and the snake bites the stick instead of the snake. And then you have all sorts of dreams about sticks and snakes, and sometimes the snake might become a stick and the snake might try to bite you, and you'd like, maybe in one dream you'd stomp on the snake, and maybe you saw your friend try to stomp on a snake and he got bit and he died. And so your mind tries to process all this and come up with what you should do the next time you see a snake so that you don't die. And that's sort of the an adaptive behavior of evolution that we sort of, this is the way human beings learn to deal with danger. And this is why a lot of times when you're dreaming about crisis situations. Yeah.
Just thinking about it a little more, it just kind of seems that when we're awake and conscious in our minds, we kind of tend to like prioritize things when we're like walking around day to day. We kind of like the first things we probably think about is logic and reason without even really knowing that we're thinking about it. You know, if you go to a long line in the cafeteria, you're not going to wait there the whole time because you know you kind of put logic and reason into a lot of your decisions throughout the day. Mm-hmm. And it seems like when you're dreaming, you're not really using your conscious mind to use logic and reason. And a lot of subconscious thoughts, I know, like come to our minds when, like, you talk about something you didn't really know that was, like, you know, boiled up in you sometimes or whatever. Just stuff that you don't really think about. But it just kind of seems that in the dreaming state, you're not really using logic and reason to, you know, determine what the scenarios are going to be. You're kind of just letting, I think, your mind just being more imaginative and not putting the real world situations and limitations on what's actually possible, you know, so your mind may be just able to be more free as far as what it thinks it can do.
It could be that there's more involved logical processes, although I've known people that, you know, they do problem solving in their dreams, and sometimes when your subconscious mind is worrying at a problem, it'll manifest itself in the form of a dream, and sometimes great inventions and insights have come out of dreams throughout history also, including some great stories and some fiction. Some of H.P. Lovecraft's stories have come out of such dreams. Let's see. Way in the back.
So I'm thinking about lucid dreaming, too, then, because we very much so have a consciousness of ourselves while we're in a state of lucid dreaming, but we also recognize that we're
right.
Dreaming while we're in that moment.
So that's... go to luciddreaming.com or... lucid dreaming is... If you call dreaming consciously or dreaming while you're realizing you're dreaming. Now, typically, you don't realize that you're dreaming. When you're a lucid dream, you get some interesting effects. You get more peripheral vision, and if you've ever had a lucid dream, you sort of recognize you're dreaming, your tunnel vision expands, and pretty soon you can, like, look around, move your body around, and then you're like, hey, I'm a dream, this is cool, I think I'll fly around or whatever. And if there's a monster chasing you, you're like, oh, there's a monster, I'll, you know, blast them with a death ray or something. And it's kind of cool. Although that, it takes, some people have them naturally, other people it's a skill you have to develop. You can even buy some goggles that you wear while you're asleep, like a sleep mask with little LEDs that'll flash when you go into REM sleep that will let you know you're dreaming. It's called a dream light. Kind of pricey, you can make your own at home. Fun stuff to play with if you're into like the inner consciousness and inner spaces, they call it. So maybe some of these generalizations about dreaming maybe are disproven with the lucid dreaming. But still, how do you know? We have our theories about what dreaming is. Why do we dream? Well, because we're mammals. What happens when you dream? Well, your brain goes into this kind of semi-dormant state. Your body's paralyzed, and so you don't hurt yourself while you're dreaming. It seems to be related to learning. But how do we know that?
Problem solve a lot, right?
Right.
Dreams.
But that seems to assume a kind of materialist basis of reality. Now, it doesn't mean there aren't souls, but it means that at least you're embodied, that this world is real. that you have a brain, that your brain produces consciousness or receives consciousness or is somehow involved in your interaction in the world. But those all seem to be assumptions from the sort of waking life. You're assuming waking life is real, dreaming is something that's sort of fake, it's an illusion. But then how do you know that? Or to take it, and maybe to make another argument, okay, let's assume that we accept all this at face value, that dreaming is what we think it is. How do you know that waking reality isn't something analogous to a dream? And I think that's really Descartes' point, in that he's not saying that your life is literally a dream. He's saying that sometimes when you're dreaming, your senses deceive you. You think you're experiencing one thing when you're experiencing another. So a dream is just one example of how something you believe really, really strongly and don't think you'd possibly be wrong about turns out to be wrong. And so his general question is, how do you know that what you're perceiving or what you're thinking about right now is the real world? And how do you know it's not an illusion? You know, like the Matrix. Or to take a modern version of this too. So you have the dream argument. Which seems to be mostly about what are called a posteriori beliefs. Which are perception. Based on perception, empirical beliefs, empirical meaning from the senses. And the dream argument says, how do I know I have a hand in front of my face? How do I know I'm walking around? How do I know there's a real physical world and that my senses give me reliable information about it? That's the dream argument. And if sometimes when I'm dreaming, I think I'm experiencing the real world and I don't know that I'm dreaming, how do I know I'm not dreaming now? Or how do I know that the beliefs would seem really clear to me and the sensations would seem to be represent the real world really aren't representing the real world? Because again, think sitting by the fire. You feel the warmth of the fire. You're like, oh, this is a nice, warm, cozy fire. I'm in my nice easy chair. I see the heat of the flames, and I can feel it on my hands. And all of a sudden, things totally change. And all those beliefs which seem to be real or to be true, to represent reality, turn out not to represent reality at all. There's no warmth at all. You were feeling warmth, but there was no fire. It was just a creation of your mind. So how do you know that you're not experiencing a creation of your mind or the creation of someone else, you know, in your mind? And then you have the arch deceiver argument, sometimes Descartes calls them the evil demon, and this is really aimed at even a priori beliefs. A priori beliefs are beliefs which are known independent of experience. So if they're true beliefs, they're known independent of sense experience. So while the a priori beliefs are based on perception, they're dependent on perception. The a priori beliefs are beliefs which aren't dependent on perception. And one way of thinking about a priori beliefs is, and typically they're thought about as being definitions of things. It should be like a subcategory.
So if this was like a math equation, perception would be the variable and everything else would be the constant?
That analogy doesn't seem helpful. It may be brilliant. But let's leave that aside for the moment. So talking about a priori beliefs, which include mathematics and geometry, and include definitions, and include logic. So, and again, these are Latin, a priori, and a posteriori. Two words. And basically mean before are after, at, you know, after experience and before experience. And so, and literally, I think just after and before, like posterior, right? That's somebody's backside. A priori, prior to. And so, before the idea is that an a priori belief is a belief which doesn't depend on experience, sense experience, such that you don't have to have some empirical proof to know that it's true. Once you understand how to count, you understand that 2 and 2 is 4, no new sense experience is going to change your mind. It's not as if, I think we talked about this the first day, it's not as if I can tell you that I have a new proof that, 2 and 2 is 5, and I can write a bunch of equations on the board, and that I show the result 2 and 2 equals 5. Right? There, you wouldn't even entertain such a notion, because you understand that 2 and 2 is 4 is a necessary truth. That it's true in all possible worlds, that it couldn't possibly be false. And so for beliefs like those, it seems like they're a special classification, and maybe the arch deceiver might fool us about our sensory beliefs, but he couldn't make us believe 2 and 2 is 5, could he? Or maybe he could. Does Descartes ask this question? Yeah.
Where would you put like hallucinations between like the spectrum of dreaming and awake and reality, I guess?
Hallucinations are sort of a different. Dreaming is a special kind of hallucination. So you have like hallucinations. Right. What is a hallucination?
Seeing something that's not really there.
Yeah, so you perceive something which isn't actually part of reality. It's a special kind of false belief. Typically, this is you're getting some sensations. It's not like a false belief, like I believe that, you know, I believe that Brazil is a city of Mexico. That's a false belief. It's not a hallucination. A hallucination is a special kind of false belief based on illusory perceptions. So in a hallucination, you could have a dream is a natural hallucination we all have. You could have LSD induced, right? induced, or all kinds of other drugs. Maybe hypnosis might give you a hallucination. Maybe some special kind of disease might, like schizophrenia, might give you hallucinations.
Alcoholism.
Or sleep deprivation, right.
And hunger, extreme hunger.
And, you know, other drugs, right, also. So these are all different ways in which different kinds of hallucinations. And so the question is, how do we know that our waking life isn't sort of a grand hallucination? And again, that's sort of the line that you get from Eastern philosophy that says that the ultimate reality is consciousness, that the universe is a manifestation of consciousness, that it's not real. Plato seems to have that sort of view as well, that he talks about in the allegory of the cave, which actually I think I might show that in a moment, the allegory of the cave. But the allegory of cave is a similar sort of idea. And then maybe I'll add one more, the brain and the bat. So some people have suggested the following. Well, look, we don't believe in evil spirits anymore. God's out, and so is the devil. And we're some hard-nosed materialistic scientists now. And so Descartes is this guy with one foot in the Middle Ages and one foot in the modern world. And his argument isn't any good because it relies on these superstitious notions of God or the devil and spirits and souls, that had this idea that we're a ghost and a machine. And if we get rid of that, this problem goes away. Well, a response to that is the brain of that argument. Which is actually goes back to the Matrix, where you have this idea that maybe in the Matrix it's your whole body. But do you really need the whole body? No, you just need a brain. So suppose we have your brain; it's in some sort of nutrient bath, right? And We got a bunch of electrodes attached to it. And it's hooked to some big, you know, computer. And maybe it's, you know, being operated by some sort of alien being or something, right?
Yeah.
Right, so I mean, again, that when you think about when you see something, what's really happening? Well, what's really happening is that you've got this eyeball, right? And it's got this lens, and it's taking the light and focusing it upside down in your retina, and then it gets converted to nerve impulses, which go along your optic nerve. They go into your brain, and your brain does this little dance of electrons, and then you know, see whatever it is, a tree. Well, if we could meter this and study what that data stream is, we could just attach an electrode to your brain and send out that same pattern of impulses, and you would see that tree. We could just mimic what your eye does. Because what's really going on in your brain is it's an electronic dance of neurons, or electrons jumping across the synapses in your brain. It's consciousness is either identical with or produced by this dance of electrons in your brain based on the sense data. So you don't really need a real tree. What's that tapping sound come from? Someone tapping. Okay, thank you. So you don't really need a real tree or a real eye. All you need is the brain and some way to send a data stream to it. Like put a little electrode in there and find that place in the brain where the optic nerve connects and just send it a stream. And you wouldn't know the difference. Now, right now, it's kind of crude, right? Basically, you stick an electrode in the outside of somebody's scalp and you juice it with some volts, and they're like, oh, I just tasted a cheeseburger. And you're like, okay, the guy's writing down cheeseburger receptor. So it gets, you know, it's not as exact. But, you know, what if this is an alien race that's thousands of years more advanced than us? Well, then they could figure it out, right? We're just sort of starting to figure it out. So the question is, how do you know you're not a brain of that? And you don't need any spirits or, you know, anything to figure out. Maybe you need the aliens, but scientists, astrophysicists, they say there probably are aliens if you look at the number of Earth-like planets that are probably in the galaxy based on our current observations. Matt?
I was going to say, do you think there's a real answer for this? Because it just seems like this is a theory that makes humans that just think, but there's no real way to tell until you actually experience the next step. So it seems like this is something that you should just kind of like go with and kind of, I don't know, it seems like it's something that it's kind of thinking about it too much just makes you kind of maybe second guess what's really real when you, like, your first instinct was what was really real. It just seems like a lot of it's kind of overthinking and overanalyzing something that is there really an answer for? Or like, are you struggling to find something that you're not going to be able to find in this state yet?
They're all theories, though. It's not called the facts of stuff. They're all theories, right?
Yeah, I think critics who have said that, like Ayn Rand has said that the problem with philosophy is that it tries to cast doubt on what people really know about the real world. It makes them question reality in sophistical ways, and it tries to create uncertainty in people's paradigm, certain beliefs about the material world, and makes them embrace some, you know, illusory or false beliefs. Let's see. Do you have a comment or question? What's your name?
Nick. I was kind of just thinking more or less of like the five perceptions, and like having this brain in this waking world of this existence that we're in, right? And like, what if there's like these you kind of like you're saying these aliens, and like, what? How do we know our brain isn't just in like a little cup and it's being fed with electrodes? But what if there's like this underlying truth that our five perceptions can't quite grasp? Almost like, you know, that saying of if a tree falls in the woods and no one's around to hear it, does it make a sound? Well, if there's a truth that we can't quite begin to grasp or even comprehend, but we can kind of conceptualize it, would it still be truth, or would it just be kind of something that's a mystery?
Well, it'd only be truth if it represented the way the world is. I mean, yeah. You do get something important that, like, if there really are the aliens, maybe, you know, if the aliens are operating our brains, we still have brains, we got that part right, and there's still electricity, and there's still neurons, right? And all this picture, it seems parasitical on our beliefs about the material world and scientific research that we've done on how the brain works and so on. Let me get her way in the back. What's your name again?
Alicia.
Mm-hmm. Then I'll get to you.
I was just thinking that it's hard to say if we, like, which dream or which would be reality, essentially, whether we're dreaming or is the brain in a vat. It's really, really hard to say which is real. And once we do that, then we kind of have to prioritize, well, this reality is more real than this reality. But it seems that the core, all we really have to work with is that I'm conscious. I'm experiencing this dreaming reality or this reality right now, whether I'm being deceived or not. All I really know in it is that I am conscious experiencing it.
And that's where Descartes thinks that knowledge starts, is this, I think, therefore I am. Right now I'm thinking. You know, I'm the thinking. And then he goes from that to I'm the thinking thing, and then tries to build from there. But his foundation for knowledge is this idea that I am a conscious being, and I'm aware of something. Isaac.
Yeah, I was going to touch on exactly what you said, the fact that your thinking is reason enough for existence. But the other thing I was going to ask was the conception of the tree. Would you have to have experienced a tree, recognized a tree, grasped a tree in order to understand it's a tree when this is being fed to you? I mean, if you're born into this vat, how would you be able to recognize, you know, the difference between black and white, blah, blah, blah? You'd recognize a difference, but you wouldn't recognize what that difference is. So I'm saying, if you recognize that that's a tree because something has stimulated your brain, then you logically have to reason that you've experienced a tree or you know what a tree is.
Well, what if the aliens, what if the brain isn't a human brain, but it's an alien brain? And, like, if you were to have a body, your body would look like this. And really, this is like a sort of a test where you're being raised to think you're this being called a human being, which never existed. And maybe the Zontarians have some theory about, like, there might be another race out there someplace in the Milky Way galaxy, you know, a long ways away from where they live, where, you know, there are these people that walk around, and instead of tentacles, they have, like, two arms and two legs, like some of the primitive creatures that they use for food on their planet, right? And instead of scales, they have skin, like the, you know, like the beans in their planet that, like, swing around from the trees that they use for food. So, I mean, you can think about the various scenarios which might, where reality might be totally different than what we experience now. And maybe there wouldn't be, like, trees like that. Maybe there would just be vines, and I don't know. You can imagine. Now, the idea is if you try to think about what there might be, you're limited by your sensations and your experiences. But how do we know what we think about it being normal and sort of trees and flowers and chirping birds, you know, that's all. How do we know that's not part of the simulation? I suppose would be the question. How do we know it's not part of the matrix created by the aliens? Like in the matrix, the waking world is pretty much like the real world, except for, you know, the real world is a little more. It's interesting. The machines who took over, they're not really aliens, they're machines in the matrix, but the machines figured out that human beings didn't do very well when they got all their needs met, and so they had to make the world kind of sucky. So you think, well, like, why does the world have all these problems if it's created, you know, this sort of simulation? Well, maybe the idea was that human beings needed this in some way. I suppose any simulation, you could, any way you look at the idea of the simulation, you'd say, well, if there's trees out, if I have an experience of a tree, there must be a real tree someplace. Maybe not. Maybe that's just part of the simulation, and that there's nothing like trees at all. Maybe the distinction between plant and animal is an artificial one. Maybe in this planet, or maybe on this planet, the plants are conscious and the animals are sort of, you know, more primitive, and they have intelligent plant life. Let me hit you with something else now while you're thinking about these things. Can someone get the lights in the back?
Imagine prisoners that have spent their entire lives chained deep inside a cave.
Sorry. Let's try this again.
Do you want to pause the recording on the thing or turn down the...
I'll turn it down a little bit.
Entire lives chained deep inside a cave. They have been chained so that they cannot see behind themselves, and they are forced to stare endlessly at the cave wall in front of them. Behind them, a fire is burning, and between the prisoners and the fire is a raised walkway. Now imagine that each day a menagerie of objects crosses the walkway. Animals, people carrying their wares to market. Their shapes create an intricate shadow play on the wall in front of the prisoners. This is the only world that the prisoners have ever known. The shadows and the echoes of unseen objects. Now, imagine that the prisoner is released. After some time adjusting to the blinding light, the freed prisoner will begin to experience the world outside of the cave for the very first time. Like nothing he could have ever imagined. With his new perception of the world, the man will of course want to return to his friends to share his incredible discoveries. But the prisoners cannot recognize their old friend. He appears as all things do. His voice is a distorted echo, and his body is a grotesque shadow. They cannot understand his fantastic stories of the world outside of the cave. To them, it will never exist. This, of course, does not make the world outside of the cave any less real. Permutation. This is from Plato's Allegory of the Cave from the Republic. And Plato thinks that the world is fundamentally caused by ideas or concepts. And he has this theory of the forms where he thinks that concepts like
the concept of man is something fundamentally real, which emanates out in a kind of a cosmic way, creates all the individual men or people. So you might say humanity is the form or the idea or concept. It exists in some eternal realm, and it creates all the individual men or and women, you know, individual humans, which exist in the world. And he thinks that's true for everything, that there's a sort of super real realm of the forms or of absolute ideas, and that material reality is somehow a reflection of that. And by comparison is the shadow compared to the reality of ideas. And that's his view. But this allegory of the cave does have the same sort of idea that there's some fundamental reality which is different from the reality we experience. And the question is, how do we know we're not chained up in the cave? And Plato also thinks that our senses, according to Plato, are kind of like that, in that our senses chain our mind into thinking that what we experience day to day is the fundamental reality. Whereas if we close our eyes and shut off our senses and think about concepts, we'll see that that couldn't be the case. And interestingly, Plato and Descartes are both rationalist philosophers who think that reality is known primarily through reason, and the senses have either a secondary role or maybe even like actually, they may even be antagonistic towards knowledge and get in the way of us knowing the true reality. Thoughts?
I had heard something, a theory once before of invading cruise ships coming to these indigenous people, and since they had never seen that type of modern vessel, that they didn't even see it. Have you heard? And I always had a hard time with that. Just because you've never seen a tree before, when you do see one, doesn't mean that it's going to be invisible to you.
Yeah, I think that's. I've heard people say such things. Usually, anthropologists try to use the examples like this to try to prove cultural relativism. I think that my understanding is that people had a hard time understanding what they were seeing.
Right.
But they saw something. They
you'd have to, you'd think you'd see it, or is it just that you're so used to looking at the open ocean and no vessel ever there that your mind sees through it?
Well, you think you'd see it more than, you know, if it's something you're used to every day, like a blank wall, and there's this big painting when we come in the next time, you know, it's going to notice that.
Yeah, and you'd see it, but sometimes, like, there are things like seeing an object at a distance and understanding perspective. If you have people who live in a thick jungle, they tend to have a hard time having good depth perception or understanding the scale of objects at a distance. And so that might have been part of what was going on there. Or the first time you see a person riding a horse, and the horse has a saddle on it, you get a bunch of saddle bags, and you might think, oh, it's like a centaur or something like that. You wouldn't know the distinction between the two beings. But once a guy gets off the horse, you kind of go up and examine the horse, you kind of get it that they're two separate beings, that the horse is an animal, similar to other animals you've seen, that's like bigger, and you can ride it around. And maybe you think, well, it's like a wild boar, you know, that maybe a kid might ride on or something like that. So you kind of can make these. Once you examine it with your senses, you get the idea. But if you haven't experienced it, it might be tough at first. But I don't think you would never experience it. You had a comment.
Well, you can compare that to like mangrove trees, for example. Like I went surfing with somebody a while ago, and like we end up way farther down the coast than we planned on when we were walking back up the sandbar, and there's like trees growing out of the sand. You know, and it kind of blows your mind, but at the same time, like, we're humans, and we learn, and that's how we develop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Isaac.
To the cave argument, if we're chained up to the cave, could we use reason to understand what we look like ourselves, and then relate what we think we look like to the shadows on the wall? In order to make a connection?
Yeah, it seems that you might like look at like your hand, and you might notice that you wave your hand like this, and it makes this distorted shape on the wall.
And then you could make the connection that that's a hand.
Mm-hmm.
So then you would just have to spend time trying to connect your perception of a hand versus what you know as a hand.
And this is somewhat what philosophers like Locke are trying to do when they analyze color. Why do we see objects as color? And when they started coming up with the rudiments of atomic theory. And John Locke, this great empiricist philosopher, who we'll be looking at later, talks about all matter being made up of, he called them corpuscles, which is basically what we think about as being atoms. And different configurations and densities and of these atoms and different kinds of atoms produce the sensations we have. And Locke says that things like shape and size, those are real, but then some of these other qualities objects have, like color, aren't really real, but they're a product of how human beings perceive the world. And so you need to make a distinction between things with, you know, size, dimension, density, weight, temperature, which are part of reality, and then that are things like color and smell and taste, which are our reactions to the real world, the way the world affects us through its real properties. And we'll get to Locke later on. But this distinction between what sense qualities are real, if any, and what sense qualities are a product of the way we perceive or a product of human nature is an important one in philosophy. And really hits up this larger question about how do we tell the difference between appearance and reality. Let's see, what else?
So how does this this shadow thing relate to, like, in Descartes' third meditation, he's talking about proving the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
He gives the example of how the rock, or the shadow, depends on the rock in order to exist. So the light hits the rock, and then the shadow is dependent on the rock. So the shadow is, in a sense, less real than the rock.
Yeah, actually, that example of Descartes is a kind of Platonic example. This idea of degrees of reality is something that Plato was really big on, and Descartes is drawing on Plato with this argument based on the degrees of reality. I think we're going to save God for next time, but... his ontological argument is based on this concept of degrees of reality, and some one thing being more real than another, and the idea that a rock is real, the shadow isn't. It's not nothing, right? It's something, but it's something which has a different kind of reality, a lesser reality, in that the shadow wouldn't exist without the light source and the object casting the shadow. Whereas the rock doesn't need the shadow to exist. The rock and the light source will exist whether the shadow exists or not. So all of these arguments are intended to question basic beliefs about perception, about our conception of the world, about abstract ideas. And going through all this, Descartes considers whether everything he believes might be false, and wonders if there's anything that can't possibly, which can't possibly not be doubted. Say this right. Is there anything which is undoubtable, indubitable? He comes up with what?
Himself.
Himself and what?
The fact that he thinks.
Thinking thing. Yeah. I think, therefore, I am. Cogito ergo sum. It's another thing to throw out at the next proverbial cocktail party you attend. What does Descartes mean by this phrase? How is this foundation for knowledge?
The fact that you can think it means you have to be. And then the fact that you're even saying the sentence, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to come up with that defines you as real, is actually here.
Why couldn't the arch deceiver trick me into thinking that I don't exist when I do? Why can't I be fooled about my own existence? Yeah.
Because there has to be something to be fooled.
Yeah, right. There has to be a being who is being deceived. In order for there to be deception, there has to be the deceiver and the deceived. Or in order for life to be hallucination, there has to be appearance and reality, and there has to be a subject of experience, the individual consciousness. And so Descartes goes from, I think, therefore I am, and then what am I? I am a thinking thing, or a thing which thinks. Now, he hasn't proved that there's a material world yet, or any of the other beliefs that we ordinarily have, but at least he's proved that he exists. And he says, try as he might, the arch deceiver will never fool me into thinking that I am nothing, because I have to be something. I am something which thinks, something which doubts, something which conceives, believes, reasons, and so on. All the permutations of thought. Yeah.
I was going to say, it seems like if there's like an arch deceiver, do you think that, and that if he's all of his, efforts were to make you think wrong or whatever, or mm-hmm. falsely, do you think that you would have a thought in your mind that there might be an arch deceiver? Or, like, do you think that should even come up if there is one? And if that is true in both cases, it kind of seems like it's almost something like, you know how Schopenhauer says that the bad's really the good in the end, kind of that whole, kind of goes on that whole thing. Mm-hmm. It just kind of seems like if there was an arch deceiver, well, maybe it's not a bad thing, because if you're thinking about possibilities of bad, it's showing you, ruling out things that you might not want to accept, you know, that like it might be showing you the bad, showing the bad to really realize the good, almost, type thing.
So maybe deception isn't such a bad thing, I suppose. Sometimes, I mean, there's this question about, in The Matrix this actually comes up. Now, in The Matrix, that from the point of view of the screenwriter, the good guy takes the red pill. And who's the human villain? It's Cypher, who says, I like this illusory world. I find it to be pleasant. And I like a world free of conflict. And I don't care that it's all fake. It's a pleasant fake world. And this is sort of, I think, the screenwriter of The Matrix, and Descartes too would oppose that view, and they'd say that knowing the truth is important, even if it makes you miserable, and that it's preferable to know the truth and be miserable than to live a lie and have a pleasant life. Although later on we'll talk about whether maybe we might challenge that belief. But remember, Cypher tries to sabotage Neo, and he's on the side of the machines, because machines are creating a pleasant illusion. And this is often seen as sort of the average person that says, if I think too much, I might realize that my life sucks, or I might realize that I'm going to die, or I may, you sort of go down the line to think about if you start thinking about reality too hard, you might find yourself being suicidal. And so maybe it's better to believe something that's pleasant, even if it's not accurate. But assuming we are interested in truth, and we're trying to figure out the way the world is, Descartes says, you got to start somewhere. And where you start is with your own mind. And you know that you are a thinking thing, you know you're a conscious mind, and that you're trying to understand something else, whatever else there is. And this is an interesting approach. This is somebody mentioned this in the forum, it's a foundationalist approach. Descartes thinks that you need to start out with a foundation of knowledge and build from it. And so other theories of knowledge think that you kind of start in the middle, or you have kind of a web of beliefs, each justifying the other. Descartes thinks that you've got to start someplace. You need a foundational belief which is undoubtable, you have solid bedrock, and only then can you start building up your edifice of knowledge. Otherwise, the whole thing's going to come crashing down. And this also hits on this related question. It's one I have in the questions for review in the text. Questions for discussion. And maybe we'll pick up with this next time. You have two beliefs. I have a soul, and I have a body. I suppose you could put body in here if you don't like the word soul. Descartes sort of treats these synonymously. The question is, which of these is primary? it matter of consciousness. Which are you more certain of? That there's a material world or that you're a conscious being? And Descartes thinks that you always have to start here. And he wants to start out with this and then prove this. But some people suggest that maybe Descartes has it backwards, that you have to start out with the material world, and then you can analyze consciousness through the scientific method, and that you don't start out with consciousness. So the question is, which is epistemologically primary? What should be the foundation? Should the material world be accepted as given, and then we can try to analyze what consciousness is, or should we start out with this idea of your first-person awareness of what there is, and then try to prove the material world exists? That's what Descartes is trying to do. So I'll leave that for next time, and next time we'll get into the argument for God's existence. So finish the section on chapter 2 on meditation. We'll talk about argument for God's existence and rationalism on Wednesday.